On this 23rd, we have present Senators Tarpin and Wilken and myself, Dyson. We will take up today SB 70 crimes involving a controlled substance and SB 78 senior care program in that order. Who's going to make the presentation on SB 70? Dean?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, my name is Dean Vanelli. In my position with the Department of Law, I occasionally attend meetings with my counterparts in other states. I've done so for a number of years. I've been hearing stories about meth labs in other states for years and years, and I think, thankfully, it was a long time before meth labs found their way to Alaska. But they're here now, and they pose a great danger to the public in Alaska. Not only are meth labs here, but the newest kind of production methods are also here.
What was that term?
Production methods.
No, the newest.
The newest. I mean, the
newest.
There are always new ways of producing methamphetamines that are being developed by chemists and by users, and the newer methods are cheap. They're easy. The original methods of producing methamphetamines usually required the skills of a trained chemist and a fair amount of sophisticated lab equipment. Over the years, newer methods were developed, and now just about any addict with access to certain, you know, fairly common materials that are available in hardware stores and pharmacies can, without much skill, put together methamphetamine, and in doing so, releases toxic gases into the atmosphere. It can expose others in the area to their effects, and some of the methods also produce explosive gases. In other states, there have been large explosions. People have been killed. Children have been killed. And so, one of the primary goals of Senate Bill 70 is to make these users of these manufacturers of methamphetamine think twice about where they're going to manufacture. Many of them are addicts themselves. They manufacture it for their own use and for selling a little bit for further purchases of the raw materials that can produce more, a lab can be set up in a hotel room, in an apartment, in the backseat of a car, literally. What the governor's bill does is that it says that if you are going to make this dangerous drug, you're knowingly making it. In other words, you know what you were doing when you were making it, and you're doing it in an area where you're reckless as to whether or not there are children residing in that area, and there's a definition of building. That's a higher level of crime than is currently provided for manufacturing methamphetamine. We simply want to make them think twice about where they're going to manufacture. If they're going to do it out in a rural area where nobody is around and no one else is endangered but themselves, that's one level of crime. But if you're going to do it in a more urban setting when there are children available, we think that ought to be the most serious drug offense that the law provides. And so that's one of the main components of this bill. In addition, and that's specifically, the definition of building is in section 2 on page 2, and the provision is on the starting at the bottom of page 2, section 4, and going on to the top of page 3. Also, in trying to keep pace with the way that methamphetamine is produced, based on recommendations from the state crime lab, the legislature has over the years made some changes to the crime that is committed when you possess certain materials that go into the making of methamphetamine. And so on page 3 at the bottom, there is an additional aspect, additional compound that is now made illegal to possess, and that is an organic solution that contains methamphetamine salts. If you do it, if you possess that with intent to extract the methamphetamine.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Earl.
Mr. Chair, thanks. I'm sorry to interrupt, Dean, but on that point, on page 3, I think you just read lines 27. And just a quick question. I don't know if it's drafting error, if it's something that happens when you put methamphetamines in an organic solution. But elsewhere in that section, just above that, you say methamphetamine or its salts. And here you just say methamphetamine salts. Is that drafting, or is that something that happens in the processing?
Through the chair, you know, that's a very good question, and I think that I'd actually like to defer that question to perhaps some of the law enforcement.
Okay, yeah,
they know that. I'd kind of relied on the crime lab to provide the language, and it may be that that something has dropped out.
Okay. So. Thank you. Thanks, Mr. Chair.
In addition to dealing with methamphetamine, what this bill also does is to address a rare situation where the state is able to, where there is an overdose death from illegal drugs, and the state is able to trace back to the source of those drugs. Under those circumstances, it's a little bit ambiguous under Alaska law exactly what kind of crime that is, or if there really is any crime resulting from that homicide. And what this bill does is to make it clear that if the state is able to do that and shows that you knowingly manufactured or delivered controlled substances that were in violation of the state drug laws, and a person dies as a direct result of ingesting them, that is the crime of manslaughter. And it doesn't matter whether you intended that result or whether it was reckless.
And for the record, Senator Green joined us about 1:41. Senator Olson had told me that he was going to be late. Mr. Grinnelli, I have a question about this. We're talking about paragraph 3 at the bottom of page 1?
Correct.
All right. So if a pardon me for being a devil's advocate here, a person makes some meth for their own consumption, and somebody breaks into their house and steals it and ingests it and dies, the manufacturer is going to be guilty of manslaughter?
Mr. Chairman, that is what this provision does.
Is there any other kind of equipment or substance that we treat this way?
First of all, this applies to all controlled substances. So whether it's cocaine or heroin, any drug that you manufacture in violation of crack cocaine that you manufacture in violation of the state drug laws, this would apply to. So it's not just methamphetamine. It's all controlled substances. And to answer your question, I don't think that there is that there are other substances with the same potential for death that are routinely manufactured for ingestion. I mean, certainly there are chemicals, there are toxic chemicals, but they aren't manufactured and delivered to other people knowing that those substances will be ingested by them. So I would say that the answer to your question is no, we don't treat any other substance like this, but I don't think that that other substances create the risk of death that illegal drugs do.
Have other jurisdictions gone down the road that we're doing here?
That's a very good question. There are other jurisdictions have, many other states have, and they really span the gamut. There are some states that make this offense first-degree murder. Other states make it second-degree murder, and other states treat it similar to this proposal, which is manslaughter. So there are a number of other states, and you know, some of the other states that make it murder, for example, Florida and New Jersey, where they have had a long history of addiction, drug sales, drug abuse, and overdose deaths. And those are two states, for example, where it's murder.
So back to my question, somebody manufactured some meth just for their own thing, locked it up in their own safe in their own house. Somebody broke in, broke the safe open, and ingested it and died. The person who locked the stuff up in his own safe would be guilty of manslaughter.
That's correct. That's correct under this bill. And I just have to say that I've never heard or known of that scenario. It's yep. it's usually people who inject each other and get the wrong dosage or whatever, and there's an overdose. It's people who sell drugs, and it's bought by somebody perhaps who doesn't have a lot of experience using drugs. It's maybe their first or second time, and all of a sudden there's an overdose. And if the state can trace it back to that person, they're engaged in a highly dangerous activity. And we think that this penalty is appropriate.
I don't know, but it seems to me that somebody who's doing it for money, doing it for a business, or doing it for some barter process is a little different than the person who's just doing it for themselves and has taken reasonable precaution to control it. All right. Do you have a question, Senator?
To follow up, and Dean, part of, and this may sound like I'm quibbling with it, but I mean, I guess when you said, you know, this is an unusual situation with a dangerous controlled substance, I mean, you can make the same argument that a person who sells liquor to a 16-year-old driver that dies in a car accident would. Or should be just as culpable as somebody who delivers a controlled substance. Maybe we do define that as manslaughter if somebody sells liquor to a youngster or gives liquor to a youngster who then is involved in a car accident. But it does seem to me that if we're doing it here, that we've got a real problem on the alcohol side too. That may be even a bigger problem than what you're talking about.
Through the chair, Senator Elton, there are penalties for providing liquor to underage persons, and the legislature has actually created a couple of felony penalties if you've done it once before, or I think if the person goes out and does something. So I think under the circumstances you've suggested. That probably would be a felony penalty already under Alaska law. But I think that perhaps the difference is that while selling liquor to a minor, you might anticipate that person would get drunk and go out and do something. You don't anticipate that directly as a result of ingesting that liquor, that they will overdose from that liquor and from that they will die. That's usually not the case. They usually pass out before they have enough to actually die. Although I suppose some deaths have occurred. I think with drugs, it's a little bit different. I mean, I think drug overdoses are a more common phenomenon than alcohol overdoses. But it's certainly a policy call by the legislature.
Just kind of, I mean, but if I remember correctly, and I might not. Delivering liquor to a minor, the way we deal with that is we call it something like aggravating circumstances or something. I mean, did you look at handling this in the same way to bump it up to a felony instead of, I mean, one way of doing it is aggravating circumstances, another way is to call it manslaughter.
Through the chair, they're using aggravating factors to enhance a penalty is one way to deal with a situation like this. But that assumes that the person has been convicted of a felony factors apply only to felony convictions. You have to first get them convicted of a felony and then apply an aggravating factor to get an enhanced sentence. We believe that this is that selling the kinds of drugs that lead to overdoses, I'm talking about heroin, cocaine, maybe methamphetamine, that those are that's a kind of inherently dangerous activity that leads to death in a sufficient number of cases that it ought to be treated with directly by recognizing that this is a form of manslaughter, and that's why this approach was chosen as opposed to some other.
Thanks. And then just a technical question. I mean, the way I read this section, you could have three or four different parties charged with manslaughter. You could have the person who manufactured the drug. You could have first distributor, second distributor, potentially. So, and I'm assuming, am I reading it correctly that that could occur, or is it just the last party before the person who died that would be?
Through the chair, it would be, it would certainly be our belief that this would apply to anyone in the distribution chain. I mean, they all, when it comes down to it, they all have the same culpability in terms of, I mean, they know what they are dealing with, they know what they're distributing, they know what they're manufacturing, they know what it can cause. And in terms of the culpability, they're all equally culpable. And to treat them equally, I think, is a goal of this.
Thanks, Mr. Chair.
Senator Green.
And I apologize for being late, and you may have already covered this. Is there any circumstance under which the manufacture of methamphetamine is useful? Do you know that?
You know, through the chair, I can't directly answer that question because I don't know. I mean, I'd like to defer that to others in law enforcement or public health or chemists. So I just don't know.
Currently, right now, it's legal to manufacture methamphetamine.
No, it is not. It is not legal at all. It's illegal to manufacture it. This bill, does a couple of things. One, if you manufacture it in a building where you're reckless that children reside there, that makes it a higher penalty. Or this first provision, if you manufacture it and someone dies as a direct result, that would be manslaughter. But manufacturing methamphetamine is definitely illegal. Whether there's any legitimate use for it, I don't believe so. I don't believe it's there is, but I'd like to defer that.
So then, the best word we can find to describe an illegal product is a controlled substance? Or is that so it covers more, a greater variety?
Through the chair, the phrase that was chosen for on page one is controls. Manufacturer delivering a controlled substance that is in violation of AS 1171. AS 1171 are the state's drug laws, where it lists, has long lists of the prohibited substances. It breaks them into different schedules. There are six different schedules, and uses a lot of scientific names, some of which are not very comprehensible to me, but certainly to chemists they are. And methamphetamine is on one of those lists. I think it's in Schedule 2.
Well, maybe controlled substance is a term of art that has a greater definition than I'm giving it. Is it?
Well, certainly a controlled illegal substance in violation of 1171 would be only those listed in the currently listed in the statutes.
So I'm wondering why the chairman's concerned if someone's making an illegal is illegally manufacturing an illegal product, why they would not be culpable or vulnerable to prosecution if something happened. That was what I was trying to get at. If it's illegal and you're not supposed to be doing it anyway, why would bother spending all the time protecting you? Have you got a different read on it than I have?
Yeah. So Cody, morphine, Now, morphine is used, and codeine are both used regularly in pain control medicines and so on and so forth. But somebody that manufactures one of those and somebody misuses it, you know, or they're a middleman somewhere in the trail of it, who had no contact with the person that misused it, and may have taken great pains to keep it from being used by somebody improperly, I've got a problem.
Mr. Chairman, just to set your mind at ease about a manufacturer of legitimate prescription medications, that would not be conduct that is in violation of AS 1171. AS 1171 talks about illegal manufacturing. If a manufacturing is done according to, you know, FDA standards and you've got the appropriate licenses, then federal law takes precedence, and that is, those are all set aside. If, however, there's drugs have been stolen from a pharmacy. I mean, manufactured drugs have been stolen from a pharmacy, and those have been sold on the street, which is very common. And somebody overdoses, then the person who stole them, delivered them to somebody else, that person would be culpable. But the original manufacturer of that drug would not be. I mean, that would be perfectly legal activity.
And the truck driver that delivered it, and
the truck driver,
and the stock boy that put it on the shelves. And,
absolutely.
Okay. Any more questions for Ms. Grinnell? Don't go away, I suspect. All right. Does anybody else from the department want to speak to this? All right. I have James Steele, if not a dear friend, certainly somebody I work with a lot and appreciate. Are you, James, can you hear us?
Can you hear me okay?
Yeah, we got you loud and clear, James. Please give us your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. As Senator Dyson was saying, my name is James Steele. I'm the Children's Services Manager for the South Central Region of the Office of Children's Services. But actually, I come in contact with meth issues from two different fronts. One, in my work with the Office of Children's Services, and then also as Deputy Chief of the Central Mat-Su Fire Department here in the Mat-Su Borough. But not only does the Mat-Su area have the fastest growing population base in the state, but now we also have the fastest growing numbers of clandestine drug lab seizures. For instance, just some of these stats that I pulled from the Office of Children's Services here and also with interacting with the Mat-Su drug team. 2 years ago, the South Central region for the drug intervention team seized 30 labs here in the Mat-Su area. Last year, that number had risen to over 50 seizures. In the Office of Children's Services, last year we took custody in 10 cases where we had received reports involving the use of meth, and out of those 10 seizures, 8 of those custody cases involved active meth labs. The production methods, when you're talking in terms of the manufacture of meth, these environments, they're not controlled environments anymore. Here in the Mat-Su area, we don't have scientists that are the ones that are working in controlled environments. The production methods can be extremely dangerous. The lab operators use extremely volatile chemicals. We've seen methanol, we've seen ether, acetone. There are other hazards that we've run into contact with, and that includes lye, alcohol, different paint thinners, iodine vapors, where they've used iodine in the process. And just to give you an idea of some of the critical situations that our workers, our responders face, the drug lab intervention teams face, and also the kids and the people that are living in these environments, phosphine gas, which is a highly unstable and poisonous substance, occurs when the cooking process gets too hot or is allowed to cook dry. We've seen that situation here in the MAP-2. There are basically two different cooking methods that the drug team and the responders have come in contact with. One is the red phosphorus method, which is named after the fact that one of the major ingredients in that is the phosphorus from matches, typically. But during the red phosphorus cook, oftentimes the cooker will combine salt and drain cleaner, and it causes a release of hydrogen chloride gas, which can cause permanent injury to the lungs and mucous membrane. So kids and people in these labs can be exposed to those extreme dangers. The other type of cooking method, which is called the Nazi dope method, has its own inherent dangers. The two specific hazards that you incur there are anhydrous ammonia and lithium. Cooks typically take the lithium strips from batteries and use that in the process. The problem with the lithium is that it can ignite if it comes in contact with water. The other ingredient there, the anhydrous ammonia, and actually last year our drug team here locally came into contact with two of the cooking processes where they were actually using anhydrous ammonia. Anhydrous ammonia is typically used as a fertilizer base, and it means ammonia without water. It's extremely dangerous to anyone that it comes in contact with. Just because of its chemical nature, the anhydrous ammonia seeks water from the nearest source, including the human body. The eyes, lungs, and skin are at risk because of the high moisture content in them. So it's not unusual to find individuals that have some type of caustic burns as a result of the anhydrous ammonia dissolving into the body tissue. A major concern that we have run across is the fact that the household walls, the carpets, other surfaces become contaminated from just the fumes that are generated during the manufacturing process. I've seen labs in which people cook in the kitchen. They use the range surface. They use hot plates. They cook in the bathrooms. We've seen it set up in garages, in basements. It's anywhere that's convenient. Each cook generates roughly 5 to 7 pounds of hazardous waste also. And what you typically find is that waste may be anywhere in the house, in the trash, dumped outside on the ground. The other problem we run into is that the materials to manufacture may be stored anywhere in the house. We've seen it in kitchens, we've seen it in bathrooms, in the cabinets, seen it in the refrigerator right next to the food, we've seen it in freezers, in closets, or just out in the open, on tables, just anywhere in the house.
James,
yeah.
I'm impressed with how much you know and what you've seen. My guess is that we are all convinced of what a horror story it is in the environment, both to have it around and how dangerous it can be if it gets out of control. But I guess, can you kind of summarize that part of your testimony?
Yes, and maybe I could do it this way, Senator Dyson. A big concern for OCS is just in children's behaviors, because what you see typically is with children, they explore their surroundings by crawling, touching, those kinds of activities, and then typically they're touching their mouth, their lips, so they ingest that. I think that the biggest concern and issue is just the extreme hazardous environments and how that impacts children and families. And not only are there short-term effects, but also long-term effects that need to be monitored for an extensive, for years after children have come in contact with the substances.
Anything else, James?
I think that's basically it. Thanks for allowing me to testify.
Well, Jim, James, in your work there in South Central, how many children have you seen come out of, that end up as China kids who came from homes where they were manufacturing meth?
We are currently getting, on average, here in the MATSU office, 40 reports each month that involve some aspect of meth, whether it's manufacturing it, an active lab, or someone, a parent, may be using meth around children. Of those, Senator Dyson, last year we took into custody, we had 10 cases where we took kids into custody. So it really, what we try to do is to find an appropriate relative to place a child with and to try to work through the process if we can without having to take legal custody of a child, but to ensure the safety of the child. But it's a growing problem. The numbers are just increasing dramatically.
All right, thank you. And can you, and I suspect there's some other people here, but can you give us a little idea of the physical, mental problems that show up in children that have been exposed to a meth lab environment? And I'm not
some of the things that we have seen as far as the physical problems have been shortness of breath, headaches, dizziness, fatigue. There is evidence now from just reading different states' approaches to the meth problem where there's been liver problems, liver damage, kidney damage to kids, even some developmental issues that have been related back to children. So some long-term effects are occurring.
All right, thank you. Are there questions for James? Senator Alton?
Thanks, Mr. Chair. And James, thanks for testifying. And you bring kind of a unique perspective with your work with OCS and with the fire department. And so kind of a specific question that you may or may not have noticed in the bill. It defines building, when we talk about child endangerment, it defines building as very broadly, apartment buildings. And so the question that I'm asking is, drawing on your experience with OCS and drawing on your experience with the fire department, is it appropriate to define a building for the purposes of child endangerment as, for example, a 12-unit condominium that's maybe one story where the meth lab is at one end and a child may live at the far end?
My answer was, based on my experience, would be that personally I think that is appropriate because the fumes may permeate from one unit to another. So just because it's being manufactured, let's say in apartment A, you may have the fumes that permeate through duct systems or just through the walls at times, through openings in the building, that may permeate into several units on down. So you do have that exposure problem.
Thanks, Mr. Chair.
All right. Any other questions for James? All right. Next, I have Bob Peters, Glen Allen. Can you hear us, Bob?
Yes, I can. Can you hear me all right?
Yeah, we got you loud and clear, Bob. Give us your testimony, please.
Okay. I was listening to the conversation regarding alcohol versus illicit drugs and whether or not you're in the same situation. And I'm a grandfather, I'm a great-grandfather, and I have a lot of concern about drugs. It's impacted my family with most families that I know of. It's had an impact one way or another. When you look at illicit drugs, any other part of our life, when we, alcohol, for instance, if you buy a bottle of Jack Daniels, you look on the bottle, it tells you what is in there, It tells you how much alcohol is in there. We do have controls and means to try to see that we don't give it to kids. If you buy prescription drugs, it comes in marked containers. It comes with explicit instructions on how to use it and everything else. And it's all required by our Food and Drug Administration, all for public safety. Even just common food is supposed to be marked as to what's in it. And yet, when you have illicit drugs that are manufactured, they're certainly not marked. There's certainly not any quality control as to just exactly what's in this package. And a person, you know, if you are going to manufacture this stuff and you're going to put it out and it's not marked, what's the likelihood that sooner or later somebody is going to kill themselves accidentally with this stuff? You know, and it's not a matter of could it happen. The likelihood is high. Sooner or later, somebody's going to die over it. They do all the time. So where's the question about can we say, well, should this be manslaughter or murder? You know, in my book, if you're going to do things that are outside of the law, and you do things such as this, it's reckless endangerment at the very least, and certainly if somebody dies as a result, there's got to be culpability.
All right. Thank you, Bob. Any questions for Mr. Peters? Appreciate you weighing in on this, sir. All right. Here we have Timothy Britt, State Troopers.
Mr. Chair, that's Timothy Burt, B-I-R-T.
What did I say?
Burt.
I'm sorry.
Yes, sir.
Please forgive me.
Yes. I'm here on behalf of the Department of Public Safety in support of Senate Bill 70 and our experience with state troopers and clandestine laboratories going back to about 97, 98 when they first started into Alaska. The hazards and whatnot that we've seen regarding these labs, whether they be in the interior, Matt Seward down in the southeast, these labs have a common thread, and that the persons that are manufacturing are backyard chemists. They're not using controls as far as the chemicals that they utilize, how they store these chemicals, or the combinations in which they bring these chemicals together and the products that they manufacture utilizing these chemicals. They have little to no regard for their own safety and well-being, and that transfers on to the regard for the safety and well-being of others, to include children, neighbors, citizens, or law enforcement. They have little to no regard for those persons as well. These clandestine laboratories, as some of the previous testimony has indicated, are extremely hazardous, extremely dangerous for a number of different reasons. Again, Department of Public Safety supports SB 70, and I'll cut it short there, and if anybody has any questions, I'm certainly available for questioning.
Questions? Senator Alton.
Timothy, thanks for your testimony, and I'm blaming Mr. Guarnelli for my asking you this question, and you may want to pass it off to somebody in the health field, but it gets back to the kind of the technical question on page 3. Lines 27 and 28. Elsewhere in that section, it talks about methamphetamine or its salts. And on line 28, it just says methamphetamine salts. And I'm just curious as to whether that's a typo or whether or not something changes in the substance when it's in an organic solution, so that it's methamphetamine salts instead of or its salts. You know the answer to that, and if not, we can check with somebody else.
I don't have the answer as to why it's defined, or through the chair, why it's defined in that manner. I know, I guess I can add clarification to what methamphetamine in an organic solution is versus methamphetamine in another solution, if that might answer your question.
It might
Okay. Get
to it, Mr. Chair. Yeah.
Okay. Methamphetamine, during the manufacturing process, there's a number of different things that occur. Methamphetamine can be washed with a solvent, say acetone. Trace amounts of that acetone could carry over and still be in the acetone. That would be methamphetamine in a solution versus the organic solution that we're referring to here is commonly referred to as methamphetamine oil. It's a stage of the manufacturing process that's found in the manufacturing processes that are commonly found here in Alaska of the two or three processes that are used. And at this stage, it's near the end in which the methamphetamine is suspended in the organic solution, and it's only about two stages, excuse me, away from the finished product.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. I'm not sure I understood the answer, so I might need to ask the health people or the chemist.
And that might, a chemist may be more useful.
Thanks for trying.
Probably an unfair question, but do you find that folks that are involved in the manufacture and distribution and sales of meth are also involved in other illegal activities?
Yes.
And I assume those are firearms violations, certainly income tax evasion, and but what other kinds of crimes?
Mr. Chair, certainly the crimes you mentioned, as well as assaults, thefts, burglaries, criminal mischief, property damage, these types of crimes as well.
Okay, so I assume that, I said the manufacture, distribution, and sales. Yeah, so I assume that many of the assaults that people are manufacturing meth are not out beating up other people. It's people that come and beat them up to take their meth.
That is the more frequent crime, yes.
Yeah, but the manufacturer isn't out also rolling drunks on the street or rolling other dealers, are they?
I don't know.
Yeah, okay. Yeah. And I assume that people who are buying illegal drugs are always out stealing, burglary, robbery, assault.
Right.
Yeah. Okay. All right. Thank you. Any other questions? Thank you for your work.
Thank you.
Where are you stationed?
I'm stationed here in Juneau. All right. Okay. Prior to that, it was Fairbanks.
Do the meth manufacturers here have difficulty getting their supplies?
No. The difference here is that the trend tends to be the anhydrous ammonia method. With anhydrous ammonia, they go to the cold plant, the fish processing plants, and typically steal the anhydrous ammonia from those plants. We don't have the sources for, say, the red phosphorus that they do in the interior and south central Alaska, where the primary process is the red phosphorus.
Yeah, there's a couple of other bills that have been introduced here recently in this session of legislature trying to have some controls over the base supplies that should be or could be misused for the manufacturer. I'd like you to think about, and maybe you too, Dean, about whether or not we ought to be asking people who store, you know, these kind of things to be more careful. You know, have more of their own internal security, you know, about that. And if you got any advice for us or, you know, that'd be helpful.
I have reviewed some of the bills that have been proposed, and I think there's some ideas in there as well.
Okay, and if you have any suggestions for improving them, I know the sponsor, my guess is they'd be very open to any help.
Boy, at this moment, I don't, Mr. Chair.
Okay, all right.
I will come up with some.
Well, yeah, all right. Okay, good. And my guess is that the ones that would, if there are some that it jumped to your mind pretty quick, just given your experience. But anyways, if you can help us, we'd appreciate it.
You bet.
Any other questions for Timothy? Thank you, sir.
Thank you.
Dr. Monsager, you're the last one I got on the list here.
Thank you, Chairman Dyson. I'm Dr. Monsager. I'm the Director of the Division of Public Health. I just wanted to speak to to quickly to Section 3 and 4 and voice my support for this. Enough has been said already about the bad things that meth does. As a pediatrician, the important thing about these home meth labs is that so often kids are in the home when this stuff is cooking. As has already been said, the fumes saturate the house. There's many chemicals. They are aromatic. They permeate toys. They permeate carpets. They permeate skin. And the precursor chemicals, in addition to methamphetamine themselves, is really dangerous for kids. I've heard reports of in some jurisdictions of as many as more than 50% of the meth labs have kids under the age of 18 in the homes. In addition to the direct physical effects of methamphetamine on the kid, the effect on the caretakers, the adults, as they become methamphetamine addicts, is they become paranoid, they are strung out and don't sleep, they don't eat, they lose their appetite, so there's their ability to provide food for their child, to take care of their child. They become aggressive, so there's violence in the home. The social and physical and psychological impacts on kids is tremendous from meth labs. And in terms of dangers to the well-being of our kids and helping kids be able to grow up to be citizens that can contribute to society, these things are bad things. I wanted to voice my support for Sections 3 and 4.
I can remember 100 years ago when I lived in Berkeley, and we used to see zombie-like people wandering around, and all the folks there just called them meth monsters. But how do people, adults who have overindulged, how do they present themselves? What do you see clinically?
The methamphetamine is very addicting. I've seen reports of as few as one dose can get somebody addicted. It also lasts a long time. It lasts for 2 or 3 days. People don't sleep. They don't eat. It's a very effective appetite suppressant. That's how it was first developed, was as a diet drug in the early part of the last century. And they become very paranoid and violent. So you have somebody who loses weight, who gets skin problems from the chemical fumes. They have psychological paranoia, anger, violence, and they lose weight, and they don't sleep.
All right. Any questions for Dr. Monsager?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I thought Senator Green asked a good question. Is there any good reason to produce methamphetamines?
Senator Wilkin, through the chair, I'm not aware. I was sitting thinking about that, and I'm not aware of any legitimate reason for methamphetamine. And so far as I know, it is not a controlled substance that's used medically in any shape or form, as opposed to some of the other controlled drugs like morphine.
Dean, would you come back up, please? Stay there, please, Doc. Senator Olson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Dr. Monsager, isn't methamphetamine a Schedule II drug?
I'm Senator Olson, through the chairman. I can't remember what schedule it is.
In fact, methamphetamine, I think, is used in certain clinical situations. Obviously, manufacturing outside of a controlled lab is not good, and there's certainly no quality control there. But as I remember, there were legitimate reasons for using amphetamines as well as methamphetamine.
Senator Olson, through the chair, there are clearly legitimate reasons for using amphetamines. We use them in attention deficit disorder. Mm-hmm. But I'm not aware of any for methamphetamine. I could be wrong, though. We'll have to look.
All right. So here's a question that maybe it's already covered, but if someone allows a child to be exposed to meth, and that child ends up, as a result of that chemical assault, ends up with soft brain injury, neurological damage, and so on, do we have a provision in the law for proceeding against that person for having assaulted that child and caused damage?
There are certainly assault statutes that make it a very serious crime to cause serious physical injury, which that would be. But those statutes talk about intentionally causing serious physical injury. there are less serious assault statutes that talk about recklessly causing serious physical injury by means of a dangerous instrument, and so I think it would be a bit of a stretch to say that I think some of these issues have been litigated in other states, and I'd have to research how successful they've been, but whether some sort of illegal drug is considered to be a dangerous instrument for purposes of assault statutes. But I guess I'd have to say that our current assault statutes are not a very good fit for that kind of situation.
Yeah, so if we're going to, and I appreciate that, and I suspect that was true, so if we're going to make someone who had no evil intention, you know, when they manufactured this stuff, even though it's bad, and it caused somebody down the chain to die as a result of the misuse or, you know, that, we're going to charge them with manslaughter. It seems to me logically that we would do the same thing if the same activities caused lifelong physical, mental, neurological damage to a person, you know, what you and I call assault. I'm going to hold this bill over till Friday, and I would ask you to look at that and see if we might be able to improve this slightly so that we also have a clearer cause for going after them on a basis of assault that results in physical, emotional, and mental, or physical and mental damage. Can you do that, sir?
I can, Mr. Chairman, and also as I was sitting here listening to the other testimony, I think I've got an idea that might make Chair a little more comfortable about the kind of situation that you suggested, which was someone who has some illegal drug in locked and secure facilities and unknown to them. You know, it might be stolen. I think we may be able to address that situation.
Yeah.
If that's still the, you know, the will.
Yeah, I think that's worth looking at, and I appreciate that. And maybe you could follow up on Senator Olson's question: are there any other areas where it's legitimate, you know, that manufacture stuff, Senator?
And something else, and not an immediate answer, but something that the doctor said, Dean. Got me into another what-if situation, and referring back to the language on page 1, beginning on line 11. The doctor noted that the use of methamphetamines can cause paranoid and violent activity on the part of the person who has ingested it. If that is the case, and the person who ingests it gets paranoid, violent, and kills somebody, does that then trigger... I mean, it doesn't say, it just says a person dies as a direct result of ingestion. It doesn't say the person who ingested dies. Would it trigger manslaughter back up the chain again?
Through the chair, I think the answer is no. I think the intent was that the person who dies is the person who actually ingests the substance. This was to directly to address overdose situations and not kind of the next step, and that is someone who goes out and does something. And I think the reason for that is that you know, overdosing is much more foreseeable. Certainly, it's true with methamphetamine and even with cocaine. I mean, there's paranoid behavior and sometimes violent behavior, but I think that in terms of foreseeability and culpability, it's more foreseeable and therefore more culpable that somebody would die as a result of ingestion rather than going out and doing something.
Yeah, I understand the intent. I'm not sure that the language...
I'll take it.
Flex it. Okay, thanks.
All right. Senator French, yes or no?
Yes.
All right. So here's a situation. Senator French has a bill that adds anabolic steroids to our list. And I understand many jurisdictions have done it. There are two other bills that are out there who have talk about making the supplies, you know, that are available, that are used in the manufacturing of meth, adding some legal things. That's HB 149 or 50?
It's HB 149, SB 106, and HB 141.
Yeah. So what I would ask you, Mr. Guinelli, you, Dr. Meisinger, and Joel, if you would think about how you as an administration and the professionals in your areas feel about rolling the content and intent of those into this bill. So we have a single kind of vehicle that's going forward. It does it. It's a judgment call, and I would ask the sponsors of those bills how they feel about it. And if they don't want it done, we won't do it. Senator French is glad to have his concern taken care of in this bill, and if the administration's amendable to it, we'll do it if it's a good idea and good policy, and I will do it. So I would appreciate it if all of you would think about where you're at on those issues. If it works, and if it's good public policy, it's certainly efficient, and I will do everything to make sure that those sponsors, those bills, get credit for their efforts, but it will be as a part of an administration bill going forward.
Mr. Chairman, I have one question.
Senator Green.
I was in a conversation with another member of the House, and they were talking about the frustration with people who have been charged, or they've been picked up, and then they're released on bail. And then before anything happens, they move to another site, and they're again picked up and released on bail. Is it ever done that for certain offenses, such as this, where flight and ease of reconstituting your kitchen, so to speak, is so easy, is it ever heard of to just deny bail until the penalty phase? Or?
Through the chair, Senator Green, in Alaska, the Alaska courts have interpreted that there is a constitutional right to bail. That means that you have a right to have a bail amount set. The courts have also said it doesn't mean you have a right to have bail set in an amount that you can meet, and the courts can set it high enough. And certainly there are statutes that specify the considerations that the court is to take into account. And so I would think there probably is some leeway that the legislature has to, with particular types of offenses, to add additional considerations that, you know, in this type of offense, the court shall consider, you know, X, Y, and Z setting bail. But denying bail, no. But
is this title violent, or is this
probably want to think about that. If the suggestion is to say that with respect to misconduct involving controlled substance, just addressing bail with respect to that level of crime, and the phrase misconduct involving controlled substance isn't a title, it may be broad enough to include that.
Well, I have an idea, Mr. Chairman. It would be done in judiciary anyway, but just kind of be thinking about, and if you find any language or any solution to that, I would entertain adding it to this.
And super excellent point, Mr. Quinelli. Can a judge, if there is a propensity for these portable manufacturing to move, can a judge order that they not relocate until the case is adjudicated?
I believe that there are, yes, I mean, judges often impose a geographic limitation on people, and I think that's something that is common. I mean, often judges will say, you know, you're not in Anchorage, you're not to leave the third judicial district, which is a big area. But I've heard judges in Southeast say, you're not to leave, you know, such and such island, and I think that certainly is appropriate.
Yeah. So you might think about whether or not is anything that we should add to the code that would encourage judges to consider, you know, those kind of restrictions in order to keep them out of business.
And Mr. Chairman, I don't think that solves the problem for this, though. I mean, because they just go to the next block and start over again. This isn't.
Sure, but then they're in contempt of court.
Well, they can certainly be arrested for violating conditions of release, which is a separate misdemeanor crime that is on the books. For some of those people, particularly if they're addicts, that may not do much, but it's certainly something that we can take a look at.
Well, is it generally the assumption, though, when you've you know, been charged and released on bail, you're released with the idea that you're not going to go out and commit another crime?
Sure, that's certainly the assumption, and oftentimes judges will try to require that the person have a third party custodian to watch over them. But with some of these offenders, there's, as a practical matter, there's nobody who's willing to do it. Oftentimes that means that they sit in jail until trial. But I assume there are circumstances where they've gotten out and moved, and we can take a look at tightening up the bail laws.
Do any committee members have any other considerations they'd like to be dealt with before we bring this back before us on Friday? All right. Thank you. And we'll suspend the hearing on this bill until Friday. Appreciate your efforts, and I appreciate the administration bringing this bill forward. We'll now take up SB 78. Who's going to be presenting on this? Thank you, Senator French.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chairman. For the record, I'm Assistant Commissioner of the Department of Health and Social Services. I'm joined by John Sherwood, who works in the Commissioner's office and has worked on this legislation. What you have before you is Senate Bill 78, which was submitted by the Governor as one part of his senior care initiative, announced prescription drug assistance and continuing cash assistance for some seniors, for the drug assistance below 300% of poverty and for cash assistance below 135% of poverty after the new Medicare drug bill becomes in effect. Mr. Chairman, I know we were before your committee last week and did present the bill. There were also some questions that came from that hearing, and so I guess I'll defer to you to say, how do you want us to proceed on this? To
answer the question.
Answer the questions.
Please, sir.
Mr. Chairman, we provided to the committee a written response from the department to the specific questions that we took away from the hearing. If there are other questions, we'll certainly try to answer them today. If not, we'll provide them also in writing to the committee. One question that was raised, I believe by Senator Wilkin, though, I may have been wrong, was how do other states, particularly Western states, treat prescription drug assistance for seniors? And I'll turn it over to John Sherwood, who did the work on this project, looking at other states, to put that information back to the committee.
Senator John Sherwood, Mr. Chair, when we did the research on other Western states, prescription drug assistance, I couldn't find any information on how states are proposing to respond to the new Medicare prescription drug benefit under Part B, but I did find information on current programs. Most of the prescription drug programs in other states are in eastern states. I found six programs west of the Mississippi that provided direct prescription drug assistance: Nevada, Wyoming, Kansas, Minnesota, and Missouri. Of those, probably the most generous is Nevada, which covers people up to about 235% of the federal poverty level with a benefit limit of $5,000. Folks are required to pay either $10 or $25 co-payments. I think the next most generous was Missouri, which covers seniors up to about 185% of the poverty level. They have a 40% co-payment, and they have a deductible based on income, and again a limit of $5,000. The Kansas covers people to about 135% of the poverty, requires 30% co-payments and a much smaller maximum benefit limit of $12,000. Wyoming is probably the most austere. They cover people to 100% of poverty, but unlike these other programs, there's no age limit on people served, and they only provide assistance with 3 prescriptions a month. So it goes from very austere to reasonably generous. Probably in the case of Nevada, they'd clearly be getting a benefit that would be more than the benefit we're proposing under our bill. There are also a number of states that operate discount card programs similar to the current Medicare discount card program, and there are 10 states west of the Mississippi. I have them listed in the written answers for you there. So that's what we found out about the West.
Mr. Chairman, if I can just continue to amplify upon John Sherwood's comments, it does create a challenge sort of comparing what we're proposing, what other states are currently doing right now, because I think all states are going to have to respond at some point to this new Medicare prescription drug benefit, which hasn't begun yet. It'll begin next year. And to some extent, that Medicare prescription drug benefit will replace some of these existing state programs. So those states are going to have to decide, well, do we now want to take what we've been spending state dollars on and use that to amplify the Medicare drug benefit or not do it? Some of these will be replaced by the Medicare drug benefit. I am not aware of how other states are progressing on addressing this question of how do our state programs interface with the Medicare drug benefit program. Our proposal on a dollar basis is fairly small, $670 per beneficiary, where you'll have, under Nevada's program, for example, the benefit per individual can be as high as $5,000. So there is a lot of apples and oranges here, and as we put that on the table of the committee, that it is difficult to make this comparison. We tried our best, but it is a little bit of a challenge to really compare what we're proposing and what states are currently doing, because there's two different paradigms or time realities that are out there.
So, Joel, as we have tried to, over the years, figure out what's fair and what's right, the cost of living here in Alaska varies depending on what it is you're doing. So the labor costs are higher, and shipping of bulky things makes them higher. But some things like hardware, tools, those kind of things are 3%, 4%, 5% higher, you know, and so on. How much higher are prescription drugs here in Alaska than they are, say, in the Northwest?
Can you answer that question? Mr. Chairman, I think you're probably going to get an answer back, though, judging by John's facial reaction, we may have to get back to you on some of the answer. I think what you'll see once you get to the retail level, when you actually walk into the pharmacy and what's that list price on the wall, for our rural communities, it is higher. What percent higher? I can't answer that question today, and I apologize.
Nope.
I think as you get into Anchorage and you go to the, you know, like a Costco pharmacy in Anchorage, I think you'll see the pricing being pretty comparable to the lower 48. So I think you are a little bit, there is that geographic difference across the state, but I think for the large urban areas, the price is not, I would not say is, at least at the retail counter level, is not drastically higher than it is in the lower 48.
Okay. But this bill does not allow a regional delta in the qualifications.
Mr. Chairman, the issue that this legislation addresses is not purchasing drugs. It's about purchasing the premiums and the deductibles for the Medicare drug benefit. And that premium and deductible cost will be the same regardless of where you are in this state. So the senior living in Bethel or a senior living in Southeast Alaska or into the interior is going to pay the exact same amount to purchase their way into that Part D Medicare drug benefit. What we're proposing is to pay that premium and subsidy, and that actually is going to be the same across the nation. This does not get at all to how much does that drug cost, and that is something that we don't deal with here because this is not purchasing drugs. I understand what you're suggesting, but we're solely looking at the cost of their premiums and deductibles to get into the Medicare drug plan, and that will be the flat rate, same for everyone, regardless of where they live in the state.
So, all right. Go ahead, continue, please.
Okay. The second large question area, I know there have been some issues, John, I don't know if you've provided it to the committee or whether you have it with you today, about, oh, it's on the last page. No, it's not in my packet, though.
Okay.
So, oh, I do have it. The last page, there were some questions that were raised as to what do the numbers really look like as you use different threshold levels. We as an administration are proposing 300%. That's where we think the line should be drawn. But there were questions raised about what do the other income levels mean in terms of number of individuals that would be served. So those are available in attachment 1, which should be the last page of this packet. And that's, I'll just, Mr. Chairman, leave that for you to read. The third subject area that that was raised at the last hearing, I believe it was raised by Senator Elton, which dealt with language in the bill that allows an absence from the state while continuing to receive the benefits. And I believe the question that we were directed was, what is the standard for the PFD? What was the standard for the old longevity bonus program? And where do we as administration stand? We provided the absence, allowable absence language for the permanent fund. And as you can see, it's quite lengthy and it's quite sizable. It's over a page in length, going, starting on page 2, going through page 3, which deals with everything from providing care to an individual's terminally ill family member out of state to being a member of Congress. I mean, it's a very large and very broad and expansive exceptions list. The language for the longevity bonus program is we provided to the committee at the bottom of page 3. It's actually quite narrow and quite small and really breaks it down simply to be if the absence is more than a continuous period in excess of 60 days. Then you would be excluded from being able to receive the benefit absent some type of waiver from the commissioner, which is, I think, probably even a little bit more austere than the language that we're proposing in our bill. The language that we're including in the governor's submission is the language that we worked with the legislature last session on around the original senior care bill, and I think that's, as administration, where we stand, though it's certainly fair for the legislature if you want to broaden that. I don't think it causes great concern for the administration, but we believe it's a good effort to make sure that we are going to provide the benefits to Alaskans who have an intent to remain in Alaska and who are residents of Alaska while still allowing an exception process and an automatic waiver for some individuals who have to leave state for health reasons and other purposes such as normal travel.
Questions? Senator Elton.
Mr. Chair, and I, this wasn't part of my question, Commissioner, but you may have some thoughts, or Jonathan might. If, in fact, the exceptions for absence for the state were more like the permanent fund dividend exceptions, do you have any idea of whether that boosts the cost of the program by a small percent or a large percent?
Responding through the chair, Senator Elton, I would not expect it to raise our costs. Quite honestly, I don't know how we'd be able to even, I'm not sure how we'd even be able to enforce various exceptions. We don't have a monitoring program. We don't really keep track of the travel of seniors in the state. So, quite honestly, I think the language that we proposed is a good faith effort to show a commitment for the state. There's a very good process. We really have no capacity to do any enforcement beyond that. I'm not well versed on what the permanent fund does. I know they have a hotline you can call and various things. I'm not proposing that for our senior care benefit.
You're looking at me, Mr. Chair. I'm giving that response. I'm going to propose an amendment on page backslash G version, page 5, line 30. And it's pretty simple. It would be on line 30, just say, and is for one of the reasons listed in AS 4323008, which is the list of exceptions for the permanent fund dividend. And I didn't know whether I was going to do this when I came to the meeting, but given the commissioner's response that he didn't think it would be that much of an impact, I hope I'm not misstating your response, Mr. Gilbertson. But also, I think it makes it easier for a person who may be getting a dividend and who may be eligible under the provisions of this bill to follow one recipe rather than two recipes. It also, I think, I mean, we could pick and choose from the PFD list. I doubt if a member of Congress is going to fall below the 300% of poverty level, and I think, too, that there probably aren't going to be an awful lot of seniors who are going to be serving in the military. But I do think that seniors are often dealing with family issues. If it's not a medical crisis with an in-law or themselves, or if it's not dealing as an executor of wills for family members and other exceptions that are allowed under the PFD. I mean, those kind of things, I think, are reasonable absences. I think it may lift a little bit of an administrative burden on the, from the depart, department because they do have language that allows for time extensions from the department for special circumstances. It relieves a burden for them, and it also gets to the issue of one commissioner's special circumstances being different than another commissioner's special circumstances. So for that reason, I would offer the amendment, the new language, and then just strike lines 31 on page 5 and lines 1 through 5 on page 6.
Object.
I had thought about that as well, and thought about us having a conceptual amendment to take the applicable portions of it, and so on and so forth. But I appreciate what you're trying to do. You want to speak to your objection, Senator Green?
No, I just think the language provided is adequate for this particular program.
And I don't, but and I, you know. The reason I will support Senator Elton is that I just know a lot of seniors who are very, very helpful in their extended family and dealing with supporting their children and, as they go through crises or surgery for their grandchildren or all those kinds of things. And I wouldn't want those seniors doing those good things for their extended families to face the penalty. But yeah, as I understand, the legislation is before us, unamended. What they'd have to do is apply for a waiver or an exception. Is that correct,
Mr. Chairman? As drafted, if the trip is in excess of 30 days, or it's not for that, or to accompany an individual for medical treatment, then they would have to get a waiver from the department. While this discussion was gone, I asked John if we've even received a waiver in the last year. We're not even aware of one. There was no funding proposed in this bill when it was initially put out, and we started senior care up to have an enforcement arm to this. So absent a funding for an enforcement arm, it's very difficult for us to enforce. We have not monitored seniors' travels in the state during the last year, nor we propose to do that. I think the language, I know you didn't ask me to say this, but I think the language we've proposed is a good faith effort. But
If I understand what you've said, nobody's applying for waivers, and nobody's losing benefits because of having been out of state longer and not having done it.
Mr. Chairman, that does not mean, however, that we may have individuals who are violating this. In fact, we probably do. But if the question is, and the direction for the legislature is for us to enforce that, then we probably would have to have some type of greater staffing capacity to do that.
All right. Any other discussion on the amendment? Call the roll, please.
Yes.
Senator Wilkin?
Yes.
Senator
Wilkin? Yes. All right, the amendment passes. Thank you. any other questions for Joel? Or Mr. Sherwood?
Mr. Chairman, I'll just say I think there was one other question that came up, actually a couple other questions that came up during the hearing, if you want us to walk through those.
Sure.
One, and I apologize, I don't know who asked this, but I think it was Senator Olson asked, where are those senior care services being delivered right now? Who's applying and where are they coming from? So we provided that information. Obviously, the bulk do come from Anchorage, we provided the breakdown of where the current recipients are coming from. These are individuals largely below 135% of poverty, so how you can extrapolate this up to 300%, I don't think it'll be relatively accurate, because I think as the incomes go up, you'll probably see a greater percentage going towards the urban populations.
The
question was raised as to how the senior care beneficiaries, how many senior care beneficiaries are eligible for IHS services as well, and will be dual eligible, and we're not able to provide that information on recipients in relation to their eligibility for IHS. We senior care has not collected any ethnic information or any of that status information, so we can't compare that. Was the last question, which I believe was raised by Senator Elton, was the pro rata language in the Senate, in the senior care legislation passed last year? And John, maybe you can answer that question.
Sure. The current law, which passed last year, did have a proration provision for the cash assistance, that if appropriation was insufficient, we would reduce the cash benefit. We also offered people the choice of a drug benefit, and there was no comparable proration for the drug benefit. There is language that says if we offer it a partial year, we only provide a partial benefit, but not linked to appropriation. So essentially, folks that had access to either cash or drugs might have their cash payment reduced, but not their drug payment. Under our current proposal, people who are eligible for the cash payment wouldn't benefit from and wouldn't qualify for the drug benefit because Medicare will already provide that assistance to them directly without the state being involved. We added the proration provisions for the drug benefit and made them the first to kick in because those are the people with higher incomes, and we figured if there was not sufficient money, we should first start by reducing the benefits for the folks at higher income levels. And
say that last sentence again, please.
Okay. For this legislation, we have a proration provision that applies to both the drug benefit and the cash benefit. And in order, it starts by removing the deductible or the coverage of the deductible, reducing the coverage of the deductible for Medicare Part D, reducing coverage for premiums under the drug benefit. And the last thing we would do would be to reduce the benefit for the cash recipients. And that's simply because cash recipients under the new program will be lower income than people who qualify for the drug benefit, and we think they should be the last to be impacted by a shortfall in appropriations.
And I think it's pretty clear. It's just how you would structurally reduce down around the appropriation amount. Naturally, you won't even have a deductible if you don't pay the premium first. So deductible for the higher income, then premium, and then the cash benefit is the way it's structured.
Anything else?
Mr. Chairman, I believe that's what we took away from the last hearing. If there are other questions,
right. You have. So, at 300% of the federal poverty level, how much income does that allow a senior to have and still qualify?
Mr. Chairman, at the 300%, which is the prescription drug assistance, not the cash assistance, but the drug assistance for a single individual, that's $34,800, roughly $35,000 for an individual. For a couple, it's $46,800. Do you have the actual dollar amount?
How did you decide that that's the appropriate, the 300% is the ideal number, percentage?
Mr. Chairman, I tried to address this in the last hearing as well. I think that if the goal is to find something to peg it to, I haven't found that natural thing out there to peg it to. So to some extent, it's discretionary. And for the administration, we believe that the 300% threshold is the right thing to do. And that's where we drew the line. We think that's the right place to make the decision that this person is or is not eligible for these benefits. That person who's receiving this benefit will be below $35,000 in income. And on top of all of their other expenses for their general existence, will now have to pay $670 cash to be able to purchase their way in to this Medicare Part D prescription drug benefit before they can even receive their first dollar of drug coverage. And for this administration, for the governor, the place to draw the line where that $670 is a burden and may actually prevent seniors from getting into this drug benefit plan is at the 300% of poverty level. And so, I don't want it to seem like a glib answer. I mean, we did that because we think that's the right place, and it's the right thing to do.
So I'm going to risk offending a bunch of people in it, but I just want to ask the question, and I'm going to say it in a pejorative way, but it is, as I understand the governor's letter here, he is saying that 40% of our seniors can't afford to live in our state and need some kind of public welfare in order to maintain their existence and take care of themselves here.
Mr. Chairman, I would say that the administration and the governor would strongly disagree with that statement.
Good.
We have a large number of seniors in this state. However, who do survive, who do work hard, who are receiving benefits from having been involved in Social Security or pensions, but they still have a challenge meeting their daily costs. We're now adding a new cost to provide a benefit, and under the extension of that logic, Medicare is a welfare program. It's subsidized by the taxpayers, but Medicare provides a host of health care benefits. It's been in existence for 40 years now. It's something seniors in this nation has relied upon as a way of delivering benefits to seniors, make sure that they can meet fundamental health care costs. We now have a new benefit being added that had never been delivered before, prescription drugs. This governor voted three times when he was a United States Senator to pass prescription drug expansions of the Medicare program. Didn't get done during his tenure, but it was finally passed. And now as this is getting ready to be implemented, and after seniors who've worked very long to get prescription drug coverage in Medicare are now going to have that, we are facing a legitimate risk that some seniors who are below 300% of poverty may not be able to enroll in Medicare Part D because they can't come up with $670 in the first year just to buy their way into that program. It's a good deal for this state to get seniors in there and get them receiving those federal Medicare benefits. And this is simply an effort to make sure that we can ensure that Alaska seniors have access to that drug coverage. I don't think that necessarily means that they are welfare recipients or that they are not able to provide for themselves. I think they have many times over.
But it is going to be, as I understood it, about 40% of our seniors will qualify?
Based on the income levels, it's not pegged at 40% of the senior population.
Right. I mean,
income levels change constantly for seniors. If our seniors become poorer in this state overall, we could have a higher percentage. The 300% was not set with a goal of covering 40% of seniors. If we had 80% of our seniors below 300% of poverty, we'd be covering 80% of seniors. I think we looked at what does $670 mean to a person who has income of $23,000 or $30,000 and has to pay for rent, has to pay for every other expense of life. And that's where we drew the line.
All right. Thank you. Any more questions? All right. Let's see. I've got Bob Peters and Glenn Allen. Bob, do you want to add anything to this discussion?
Well, one thing that I'd like to add, I am a senior myself, and my wife recently qualified for Medicare, and everything that you can do to keep things simple is really important to understand what's going on. Among other things, besides getting more forgetful and everything as we get older, when you start taking some of these medications that are come under these things, it starts getting a little harder to understand this stuff. And I can tell you from recent experience when all of a sudden you get your Medicare stuff, so things are changing there, and then you're trying to figure out what all these benefits are, and then your normal health insurance suddenly notifies you also that they're changing, and then we have this come up. Pretty soon it gets pretty confusing, to say the least. And so the standardizing for the PFD for eligibility, I think, is a good step in that direction. But whatever you do, we need to have things simple so that people can understand what benefits they're entitled to and when they are and when they're not.
Yeah, thank you, Bob. Any questions for Bob? All right, we'll go to Pat Luby in Anchorage.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee. My name is Pat Luby. I'm Advocacy Director for AARP. I'm here today to express AARP's strong support for the Governor's Senate Bill 78. This bill is an enhancement of what the Governor proposed and the legislature passed last year. The senior care program that you passed would sunset at the end of 2005 when the Medicare program begins its new Part D. Senate Bill 78 would extend senior care and make it complement the new Medicare program. AARP has significant concerns about Medicare beneficiaries not signing up for the new Part D benefit. We know that there's extreme confusion about the new Medicare benefit. We know that many older citizens are concerned about the additional $35 monthly premium. For an older couple, finding an extra $70 a month in their retirement budget may not be very easy. Senate Bill 78 will pick up that $250 deductible as well as the monthly premium cost. but limited to $670 a year. The commissioner estimates that this could help as many as 10,000 older Alaskans. Our lowest income older Alaskans will have these costs assumed by the federal Medicare program. Congress started the Medicare Part D program 40 years after Medicare was passed. 40 years ago, we didn't have that many pharmaceuticals, and they weren't as expensive. But the senior care program, as well as our Medicaid program, our state employee and retiree health program, recognize that drug coverage is smart medicine. Today, physicians keep many of us away from surgery simply by prescribing medications that keep us healthy and out of expensive hospitals. Healthcare costs are higher in Alaska, 40% more than outside. Older people use more health services. Senior care was a major step forward helping older Alaskans cope with their increasing cost of pharmaceuticals. Senate Bill 78 will extend those benefits considerably and benefit even more of our older citizens. AARP recommends your strong support for Senate Bill 78. Thank you.
Thank you. Is there any questions for Pat? Thank you for your work for our seniors, Pat. Here in Anchorage, I have one more person that, or here in Anchorage, whew, here in Juneau, I have one more person who would like to testify, Frank Apple.
Mr. Chair, I'm Frank Apple. I'm a commissioner on the Commission for Aging. I'm here to support the senior care bill, and the commission feels that this is a needed bill to provide a safety net for our seniors. In talking to Dan Carman, who is our commissioner from Nome, he has met with seniors that are recipients of this assistance, and they've expressed how much this helps them to just get by, to be able to lead a life that provides for their well-being. I encourage you to support this bill.
Thank you. Any questions? All right. Any discussion?
Mr. Chair, I apologize because it was my inartful, I think, suggestion of language for military that's going to prompt another amendment. I think what I did with my language is I eliminated the excused absence for a 30-day vacation or business trip. Because we eliminated that, we eliminated that as part of the amendment that struck the language down to line 5 on page 6. So, I'm amending the amendment so that we can maybe get the senator from Palmer to. Oh yes, but I think on line 30 we need to add. After an individual's absence is temporary for a vacation or a business trip of 30 days or less, and for one of the following reasons listed in AS 4323-008, so that we allow business trips and vacations.
So you're proposing Amendment 2, as you've just stated?
Yes.
Is there objection?
Yes. Let me go back. What page is that all on?
It's on page 5, line 30. Mr. Chair, and Senator Green, after temporary comma, and then inserting language, for a vacation or business trip of 30 days or less, or is for one of the reasons listed in AS 4323-008. That allows the seniors to take a vacation.
Mm-hmm.
the objection maintained? Seeing no objection, Amendment 2 is adopted. Any further discussion? The wish of the committee? Senator Elton?
Mr. Chair, I just put the bill away. I move Senate Bill 78 with the attached fiscal notes backslash version G with individual recommendation.
Object. I'll just object just to get a few things on the record and then remove my objection so it passes on to finance. I've got really great concerns with this bill, and I just would like to get them on the record now so that we have 75 days to work on them. I'm really concerned about the cost. It's a $20 million bill coupled with the dental care issue that we talked about last week. That's another 10, so there's $30 million. We came back to town 45 days ago, and we're now struggling with an $80 million Medicaid increase that we didn't expect. On the horizon is better than a 50-50 chance that we'll be incurring over $70 million a year with our FMAPs. And the common thread that runs through this is that it's tens of millions of dollars, and so we're now contemplating adding another program, or two programs. That bothers me. I'm concerned about, having been stung by Denali KidCare, I'm concerned that today, or at least in 2011, it'll be $20 million. I'm concerned, is that really a good number? Because my limited experience has been that it seems to grow and grow out of our control. And I suspect that may be what happens here. So cost is one problem. I think another is the bureaucracy that we're going to put in place to monitor this. And I thought Senator Elton's amendments brought this to the front. There's probably not an office in this building that doesn't, if not by the week, certainly a couple of times a month, have a request, a concern, an inquiry, an appeal having to do with their permanent fund dividend check. So it seems like we're setting up another bureaucracy that we're going to monitor people's vacations and absences. So we're going to add to the bureaucracy in order to, on top of the $20 million. I'm concerned about the 300% poverty level. No one else from the research is even near that. And I understand, Joel, and I appreciate how you got to that number. It's somebody making $17 an hour. But and it's subjective at best, and I appreciate that. And fourth, at the risk of offending people that might want to move to Alaska, I don't want to have the Cadillac program for this. I don't want to be the first out of the chute to take care of what the federal government has foisted upon us. I remember from my 2 years with the Long-Term Care Task Force that there was a couple of things I took away. One of them was the graying of Alaska and how it's at the risk of not finding a better word, how we have and continue, and with this type of legislation would put in place another magnet to draw older citizens to Alaska. I think that cheats the Alaskans that are here today. So I don't want this to be a magnet. I don't want us to have the best. So having said all that, Mrs. Ford, other than that, how'd you like to play? I would say that we have 75 days. I think the effort here is genuine, and I understand the need. But I guess the challenge for us, rather than just to throw it out, is to figure out a way through the budgeting process to find $30 million that we can get rid of in order to come up with a program like this that's sustainable and fulfills a need that I think we all know is there. So with that, I would work with Senator Green and Finance Committee to try to work through this, but that notwithstanding, us not being able to find an offset to these sort of costs in the program itself and the impending costs being that are on the horizon that surely will happen, I suspect that this may be a program that today is premature. We may visit this at some time further on in another legislature. So with that, I'll remove my objection. Are there further objections?
All right, seeing none, SB 78 passes on to the next committee, which I believe is Senate Finance. And no further business to come before us today. We will take up SB 70, hopefully if we can get all the feedback back on Friday. And thank you all.